Hello, my name is Kathy Giorgio, and my favorite thing is writing.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hello, and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and this is the podcast where we learn about people's favorite things and get recommendations without using an algorithm. I'm very excited. We're sort of in the quiet week in between Christmas and New Year's, at the end of the year, and I am joined this evening with an author, Kathy Giorgio. She is based in Wisconsin. She's a critically acclaimed author of 7 novels, 2 story collections, a collection of essays, and 4 poetry books. Her latest release from February of 2023 is Hope Always Rises, but she has a book coming out in October of 24. She has been nominated for the Pushcart Prize in Fiction and Poetry and awarded several Literary Excellence Awards. Kathy's work has been included in exhibitions and performed on stage. She's also the director and founder of the international creative writing studio, All Writers Workplace and Workshop, LLC. Kathy, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good. Like I said, it's that quiet week in between Christmas and New Year's, and I am enjoying every cold, quiet moment of it.
Me too.
We were commenting before we hit record that winter is finally coming for the Midwest today, it seems.
It does. It's only raining, though. It's not snowing. Yeah. So fingers crossed, we've got another 6 degrees to go before we hit freezing.
Yeah.
So hopefully no snow.
Hopefully no snow. Hopefully not. I don't want an ice storm either. I'm not interested in that. So awesome. Well, Kathy, I'm so happy we were introduced. You are in, I don't know if it's fair to say it's a quiet period in between 2 publications.
It's not quiet at all.
No. Tell me a little bit about the projects you've got going on right now.
Well, right now I'm working on my 8th novel, which is coming out in October. It is called Don't Let Me Keep You. And when I started working on this, I thought, what am I doing? Because I tend to write about more difficult subjects. Mm-hmm. I've written about rape and recovery from rape. I've written about abuse. I've written about depression. I've written about suicide. Everything. Mm-hmm. And this time I'm writing about motherhood. And I thought, it's just motherhood. But as I've worked my way through this book, there is no bigger topic.
Yeah.
It is just an all-encompassing, life-changing, lifelong thing mm-hmm. that affects everything you do and your thoughts. And so the book is about a woman who in school, she was gifted in math and she was a genius in science. And so she was kind of being corralled toward that life. Her family wanted her to be a scientist or a mathematician or somebody who cured cancer or, even someone who is going to bring equality to women and put mm-hmm. women in roles that are mostly taken by men. And she discovered when she started babysitting that she really, really loved being with children. Mm-hmm. And so she decided she wanted to be a mom. She wanted at least 10 children. And her name is Hildy. She married a man named Hank. Their last name is Halverson. So mm-hmm. she decided all the kids should have names beginning with the letter H.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about then she tells each child as each child is born, you can be whatever you want to be, but whatever you want to be is going to be great. And she was determined not to influence them, not to force them toward a certain career.
Mm-hmm.
But as the book goes on, you find out that no matter what you do, you have an influence as a parent.
Of course you do.
Right.
Yeah.
So the book is written in an unusual format. I'm a huge lover of the short story. So almost all of my novels have short stories within them.
Mm-hmm.
So each chapter shows when each child is born and she has that first moment alone with that child. And she gives the promise, you can be whatever you want to be. And then the following chapter is that child at a later time so okay. that you could see what happens with that child. And then all the way through, you're also seeing Hildy's development mm-hmm. as well as she grows and becomes many things.
Yeah. What's the time period that it's set in?
It starts in 1978 mm-hmm. when she is 12 years old. And I think the final year is 2028. Okay. So we bounce back and forth quite a bit.
Nice. So is exploring time non-linearly something that you regularly do?
Yes, I've done that before. To me, I wanted to give a panoramic view of family life.
Mm-hmm.
And the way to do that was to show where it starts, but also where it goes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm all over the place in this book.
And are you someone who, one of the gifts of this podcast has been that I talk to a lot of writers and I love it. So I'm curious, are you an outliner? Did you know where this book was going when you sat down to start it? Or do your characters come to you during the process?
It comes to me during the process. Mm-hmm. I am absolutely not a planner. You know, I write by the seat of my pants mm-hmm. all the time. Though I think even that question, are you a planner? Are you a pantser? Which is, you know, the typical thing I get asked and many writers get asked. We're both.
Yeah.
Because when I'm in the first draft and I have no idea where things are going, that for sure, I'm a pantser. I mm-hmm. write whatever comes. But subsequent drafts, everything is about the planning.
Right.
And, you know, now I know where the book is going. And so I can start manipulating the book to go where it's going to go. The beginning might not even match anymore by mm-hmm. the time I start draft two.
Yeah.
But the original creation, definitely off the top of my head, I have no idea what I'm doing. So, and it's fun that way.
Yeah. And what's your writing practice?
I'm an afternoon writer, pretty much because I have to be.
Mm-hmm.
With the studio, with all writers, I work with writers from all around the world. And so my mornings are spent with coaching clients. Afternoons I write, and then evenings are spent either in classes or with more clients or reading manuscripts for the next day.
Okay.
So I have a stretch of time in the afternoon. I'm usually at my desk by 1 o'clock. And I write until about 5 o'clock when the evening kicks in.
Mm-hmm.
I don't write on Wednesdays because I have an afternoon class. So I write Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. Don't write on the weekends because that's preparation for the manuscript reading for the week.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much what I do. I find that, and I coach people to try to find a set time of day that you write and a set place that you write. Because we are very much like Pavlov's dogs.
Mm-hmm.
If we get used to a certain routine, you sit down, you're at that spot, you're looking at that screen, and your head goes immediately toward what you were working on, mm-hmm. and you're able to sink right back into it.
I'm curious about the workshop. It was listed in your bio, and you've mentioned it, the All Writers Workplace and Workshop. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about a little bit about that?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's a huge part of my life. I've been teaching for a total of 29 years. The studio is 19 years old, or it will be in January. And I wanted to create it to be not just a place of education for writers, but a place of encouragement and a community. So it is a place where I have beginning writers, writers who have never even put a word down on the page yet.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have writers who have 5, 6, 7 books out. So yeah. We become a very big community. It is international. It's around the world. We teach online. We do Zoom. And I have a classroom. I live in a live where you work condo. So mm-hmm. the first floor is my business. It's the studio. And then I live on the second and third. So we have live classes and coaching clients too.
I love it. And do people, because if it's, you know, 19 years ago, we had Skype. But we didn't, mm-hmm. like, we certainly didn't have Zoom. We certainly didn't have the, like, video, the remote teaching, as easy a remote teaching. We had conference calls.
Mm-hmm.
So did it start as a local workshop that became international, or did you always aim for it to be an international community?
It started as international.
Okay.
I originally taught on AOL chat rooms,
mm-hmm.
you know, where we would go in and we would type ourselves through the class
yeah.
or through the coaching. When I had my website developed, I had a chat room put on it
mm-hmm.
so that I could have people from around the world that would meet me in the chat room. Then we went to Skype. And from Skype, of course, we went to Zoom during the pandemic,
right.
which was a lifesaver for us.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always wanted it to be international. before I opened the studio, I was teaching for Writer's Digest and Writer's University and, you know, and then local universities and colleges too. So I was already teaching people from around the world, mm-hmm. and I wanted to be able to continue doing that.
Well, it seems like a natural progression. Like what we're going to talk today, your favorite thing is writing, mm-hmm. but I don't want to leave the current book too quickly.
Okay.
It'll be available in October.
Mm-hmm. October 3rd is its release date.
Okay. And is it available for pre-order now?
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay. So people should, you know, make a mark. And when it becomes available for pre-order, I'll add it to the, I have a bookshop.org little affiliate page of books by guests and books recommended by guests. So we'll make sure to get that added so people can look for it.
Excellent.
And what about the book that came out in February of this year?
That was Hope Always Rises.
Was that also a novel?
Yes, it is also a novel. It also includes short stories. This book took me by storm, which, you know, it's a perfect example of writing by the seat of your pants, mm-hmm. because when I started it, I had no idea it was even going to be a book. And it's a little different from my work. It's still literary fiction, but it's also magical realism.
Okay.
It is set in a special gated community in heaven that is only for people who have chosen to end their lives.
Mm.
So I've taken on a lot in this book. Hope is the main character, hence the title.
Mm-hmm.
God is one of the main characters, and I had a wonderful time writing God. He is an incredible guy.
Mm-hmm.
He insists that everyone who lives in this community go to group therapy once a week. And Hope's first group therapy leader is Virginia Woolf.
Mm.
So I got to write her too. And I love this book. I mean, it sounds terrible that a book about suicide is funny, but it is.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much in it that just made me laugh out loud while I was writing it. And yet the short stories within the book are all the stories of the people in her group therapy group. So we get to learn the reasons behind that choice, mm-hmm. all the different reasons why that choice might be made, and the outcome.
Yeah. It sounds so. This summer, a former supervisor of mine died by suicide.
Okay.
And he was CEO of a company, had just turned 50, a kid in college, one in high school. Heartbreaking. It's always heartbreaking. And I had a real hard time finding like just even 1 ounce of empathy or forgiveness, or I was really angry at him. And Maria Bamford's memoir came out and she has a chapter about suicide in it. And I happened to listen to it like 2 weeks after the funeral. And I was like, okay, she's kind of pushing a door open for me to access an emotion other than anger.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like your book is for people who maybe have lost someone by suicide, that yep. this might be a way that they can explore different ways of finding some empathy, an emotion other than anger.
Definitely. And the book came about, I mean, with what I do, working with writers, we all know that people who are in creative lifestyles tend to have a higher rate of suicide than other groups in the mm-hmm. world. And no one has ever really understood why, but we do. So I've known a lot of people who have passed because of suicide. Mm-hmm. I was at a coffee shop having lunch, and these two women were sitting behind me, and they were talking about a friend who had recently made that decision. And they were just shredding her. Mm-hmm. How could she do that? How could she do that to her children? What an awful, selfish, monstrous thing to do. And I finally stood up and looked at them and I said, you're asking the right thing. How could she do this? But you need to ask it with what kind of pain was she in that mm-hmm. she honestly felt that this was a reasonable answer?
Yeah.
And then I walked out and started to write the book.
Mm.
So it's for people who have felt that, who have felt that desire. It's for people who have lost someone due to suicide. And my biggest concern when I was writing it was I didn't want to come across as someone who is justifying it. who was saying it was okay. So they do still, in my little gated community, every day they have to look into a portal to see what is going on with the people they left behind.
Mm-hmm.
So that they can see the hurt they caused. They can see the continuous reaction. I mean, with Hope, she has to look back and see what her husband and her two children are going through.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't get let off the hook.
Yeah.
You know, they do learn the full impact of their actions. But likewise, people on the other side of that, people who are left behind, will learn the impact of why did they make that decision in the mm-hmm. first place? And what happens to the human mind as that decision is made.
Yeah. And you also didn't send them to hell.
No. And in fact, in my book, God says there is no hell. It's mm-hmm. a human construct.
Yeah. Amazing. So something else we emailed about briefly that we have in common is that we have both had breast cancer.
Yep.
I'm curious if any of your seven, it's pretty hard to go through cancer and not have it impact your creative process.
Mm-hmm.
But have any of your novels directly handled cancer?
Yes. At least bits and pieces of it. And in Hope Always Rises, one of the stories is about a woman who has breast cancer show up for the third time as bone cancer, and she decides not to have treatment. That's and in her mind, she was like, you know, I could kill myself right now and end the suffering, but I don't want my husband or my child to find me. So I'm just not going to go for treatment. And she doesn't tell them that treatment is even possible. She chooses to let the cancer kill her. So it's addressed there. I also write a blog called Today's Moment of Happiness, Despite the News. It's now This Week's Moment. There's a painting behind me, and that is the cover of a book that came out as a result of the blog. She's holding a pink typewriter, which is a reference to breast cancer. And I'd started writing the blog right after the inauguration of President Trump when I was walking my dogs around the block and I was approached by a man in a MAGA hat and he went to kick one of my dogs. And I got between him and my dog. He kicked me instead. He threw me off the sidewalk. He shook his finger in my face and he said, "It's time for you to go back in your place now, woman." And so I became one of the national hate crimes that occurred after President Trump was elected, made national news. That was not how I ever wanted to make national news.
No.
But the fallout was worse. I put it up on social media and I began to get hate notes from Twitter, from Facebook, email, in my actual physical mailbox, threatening my life, threatening my family's life because I was putting down our wonderful new president. The worst one was a note in my mailbox that said, "We know where your daughter goes to school."
Fuck.
And I got to the point that I was scared to leave home.
Yeah.
I felt like I was living in a fishbowl, but I knew, I mean, this is what I do. I have to be able to get out and talk to people. So I said I was going to write one moment of happiness a day. And I was going to post it on Facebook because I knew if I did it myself, it would last 4 days and I would quit. So I posted it on Facebook. My Facebook page flooded and thousands of people who wanted to know what made me happy, which was, I was like, "You're kidding." So I moved it to my website, to a blog. My website crashed several times until we increased the bandwidth. And I, in the heat of the moment, I said, "I'm going to do this every day for a year."
Yeah.
Not knowing that 2017 was going to be the year, besides the assault, my husband was going to lose his job twice and take our health insurance with him. My daughter, who is high functioning autistic, was going to be bullied so badly in high school, we had to move her to a new high school. And I was going to be diagnosed with breast cancer.
Whew.
So that blog during that year, a lot of it was my journey through breast cancer. I was diagnosed on June 27th, 2017. And so that's the book of essays, which is called Today's Moment of Happiness, Despite the News, is that year. And a lot of it covers breast cancer and my experience with breast cancer.
Wow.
And I still write it today, but only once a week because I got done with the year and I was like, "Why did I say I would do it every day? Oh my God." So I switched it to once a week, which was today. I just posted one today. But there are days that it's like 15 minutes to post time, and nothing has made me happy this week. What do I do?
Right.
But I did it. I posted every day for a year, and it was an amazing experience.
Wow. I mean, a daily writing challenge with none of your trifecta of difficult life events happening. It would be like if nothing bad had happened other than Trump, right? Like if the other things hadn't happened, it would, you probably still at the end of the year would have been like, all right, I'm not doing this every day again.
Right. Right. Yeah. Exactly. And I didn't write it to be a book.
Right.
You know, all of these are very raw. The most I did was check for grammar and spelling mm-hmm. and punctuation. I did not rewrite them otherwise. And so we got to the end of the year and I was like, oh, thank God. And then people said, well, it's going to be a book, right? And I said, no.
No.
But it was the publisher who said, Kathy, they're asking for a book. Don't you think mm-hmm. we should do a book? So we did a book.
Outstanding.
Totally unedited. Totally unedited.
I love it. So, Kathy, we've already been talking about writing, mm-hmm. and it is one of your favorite things.
The favorite thing, yeah.
The favorite thing. So I would love to time travel with you to when you were a little kid, a teen. When did writing catch you?
I honestly don't remember a time that I wasn't either storytelling before I could write mm-hmm. or I was writing. I'm told that when I was wee little, I was kind of creepy to watch play because mm-hmm. I would take my toys and set them up in scenes. And then I would sit back and fold my hands in my lap and I would be telling the story in my head.
Wow.
And yeah. then when the scene changed, I'd move it again. But nobody ever knew what I was doing. I was just sitting there staring at my toys.
Mm-hmm.
When I physically learned how to do letters and to write, I'm going to really age myself here. I used carbon paper and I would trace the pictures out of the books I was reading. And then I would rewrite the story the way I felt it should go.
Mm-hmm.
So I began to write very quickly. In fifth grade, I was in way northern Minnesota in a very, very conservative area. Girls couldn't even wear pants to school in northern Minnesota. It was ridiculous.
Mm.
But this new teacher came and she said she was going to have us do creative writing on Thursdays.
Mm-hmm.
And I still remember Thursday. You know, that's probably why I do the blog on right. Thursdays. And so I went in that first day and again, aging myself, she put a record on the record player. It played a song called O Shenandoah. And we were supposed to write our impressions of it.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a short story. Complete with conflict resolution, dialogue, description, all of it. Got up to read it to the class. And when I finished reading, the class was silent. And my teacher from the back of the room said, oh my God, Kathy, you're a writer.
Mm.
And it was like putting on a coat that yeah. fit exactly because I had not connected what I was doing with what I was reading. I wasn't like those authors. I was just in my head playing.
Right.
And then suddenly she said I could be one of them.
Yeah.
And that's where it took off.
Wow.
And so it's a major part of my identity.
Yeah.
You know, before I say I'm a wife and a mother and a woman, even I say I'm a writer.
Mm-hmm.
It's beyond my favorite thing. It's my life force. It's what I do.
Yeah. So you have a teacher. Mm-hmm. Who tells you, in fact, you are a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, what happens?
I kept writing. I was very lucky to have many, many excellent teachers. Mm-hmm. I went to three different high schools because my family moved a lot. The high school I graduated from, I had creative writing and I had an amazing teacher who I'm still friends with today. And so he has been a huge force for me. He was one that always said, you can do this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he helped me when I began to look at colleges. I did my undergrad at the UW in Madison.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote the head of the English department and said, you can't put her in beginning classes. So I was the first freshman to be allowed into graduate level writing courses.
Wow.
Which was hard and wonderful because there were so many people that didn't feel I should be there because sure. I was only an 18-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. My first teacher there was Kelly Cherry, who is she was an amazing writer. And when I had her, I absolutely despised her because she tore me apart piece by piece, which mm-hmm. I had never experienced before. I had always been built up. And I know at one point when I had to go into one-on-one with somebody, the head of the English department asked Kelly, and Kelly said, "I've done everything I can with her," and stormed off down the hall. years later, Facebook, I reconnected with her.
Yeah.
And I had her come teach a special class here at the studio, and I had her come be keynote at the Southeast Wisconsin Festival of Books, which I'm a large part of. And we became really close friends. I mean, yeah. She did for me what I needed at that time. Sure. I needed to know that just because I was good at what I did didn't mean instant success and didn't mean that I couldn't improve.
Yeah.
And so she kicked me around the block a few times. When I went to college, my parents were of the firm belief that I should not write as a job, that all I was going to do was sit at home and dream of being the great American novelist mm-hmm. and never really do anything. So they said I couldn't major in English. So I majored in special education with a focus on autism, which is odd now to think about it, that mm-hmm. I have an autistic daughter. I majored in social work. And then I said, screw this. And I went and changed my major to English and told my parents if they weren't going to support me anymore, that was fine. I would yeah. quit college, I would work, and I'd support myself. They continued to support me, but whenever anybody asked them what I was majoring in, they said, oh, she's getting married, because I was engaged at the time.
Okay. Yeah.
So there was never a whole lot of support there.
Right.
It was more, you know, Kathy's off dreaming again. But it took me a while. I mean, I started publishing. I published for the first time at 15, a short story in the Catholic Herald Citizen, of all places. Hmm. I rewrote the story of Christ in 1970s slang, which was fun.
Yeah.
And then I was pretty well known as a short story writer pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But the book was elusive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I went through four agents, couldn't get a book deal. Eventually sold my first book on my own without an agent, and it came out when I was 50.
Mm.
So it took a long time to get there, but it has never been anything that I'm willing to give up.
Yeah. And then since the first book, 7 novels.
This will be the 15th book in 14 years.
Wow.
When it comes out in October.
Okay. Yeah.
So, amazing. There's no stopping me. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. And so you mentioned you've been teaching 29 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then you started the workshop 19 years ago.
Correct.
So when you started teaching, what were the opportunities for teaching that you found?
I didn't choose to become a teacher. It found me.
Mm-hmm.
I was writing at home. And I had a part-time job doing something. I don't even remember what I was doing. I was married. I had 3 little kids. And our local park and rec department contacted me and said they had a creative writing class that was called Senior Scribes. It was for people 55 and up.
Mm-hmm.
And their teacher just suddenly left.
Oh.
And they didn't have anybody. And would I be willing to do it? And my first response to that was, hell no.
Right.
I don't want to teach. And I mean, a class called Senior Scribes, I was like, they're going to be, I was like 35 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, they're going to all be old people. They're all going to be writing about their grandkids and their latest operation. No, I don't want to do this.
Uh-huh.
And my now ex-husband, who only saw dollar signs, said, you need to do it.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, fine, I will do it. But if I'm ever teaching more than I'm writing, I'm quitting.
Yeah.
Well, I'm teaching 85 hours a week now.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And I've been doing that for 19 years. I walked into that first class and a man read a poem about his wife's bracelet on her wrist. And the poem was so sensual, it made me sweat.
Mm.
And then another one wrote about growing marijuana in his backyard. And I was like, I've got a whole lot to learn here.
Yep.
And I loved it.
Yeah.
And so I went from that. I convinced Park and Rec to give me an evening class, too, with no age requirement. And by the end of that first year, when word got out that I was teaching, and not only was I teaching, but my students were becoming successful.
Mm-hmm.
I showed them how to get published. I showed them what you do to get there. And I started having students who were publishing. So I was asked to teach at a lot of community and continuing education classes at local universities and college, was asked to teach for Writer's Digest, was asked to teach for iUniverse, all sorts of places came forward and said, would you teach? And so I was teaching 65 hours a week by the end of that first year.
Wow.
And then I thought, why am I doing this? Why am I traveling all over the place?
Mm-hmm.
I can open my own place.
Yeah.
So I opened All Writers and now do it under one roof. But now 65 hours a week looks like a vacation.
Right.
Instead, it's because nobody told me that running a business meant having to do the ledger and having to hire faculty and having to do promotion. And it's a lot of work, but it's a lot of joy.
Yeah. The first time I had my own business, towards the end of that experience, I had a company called Native Arts and Media. And I was a social media coach I thought it was going to be for writers, but ultimately it wound up being for like musicians, and it was rabbis and rock stars.
Wow.
That's who I taught social media to.
Oh my God.
Because musicians understood you spend money to make money. And so musicians didn't mind spending $300 to learn how to use Twitter and Facebook. This was in 2008, 2009.
Okay.
So I would just do like a one-off lesson, give them a workbook and say good luck. I didn't take on their Twitter accounts. I didn't do content creation. I was just like, you can do it on your own. I'm just going to teach you the tools.
That's important.
Yeah. But towards the end of that, one of my musicians, Brian Mazzaferri from the band I Fight Dragons.
Cool.
Mentioned that he had read the book, The E-Myth Revisited.
Okay.
Which is the myth of entrepreneurship in America. Like, if you're good at baking cookies, you should open a bakery.
Uh-huh.
And this book was about, like, if you're good at baking cookies, that's fine, but you have to do the ledger, you have to hire people, you have to become a sanitation person, you have to become a real estate person. Like, do you want to take on all of the other jobs of entrepreneurship to sell your cookies? And that's when I went looking for a full-time job again.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I actually don't want to, I love teaching people social media, but I don't want to do the business side of the work.
Right.
You know?
Right. I know I've been asked a few times if I would speak to groups about entrepreneurship.
Mm-hmm.
And I've said, you probably don't want me to, because I would say, don't do it.
Yeah.
I mean, the rewards are amazing, but I'm 63 years old now and I'm still teaching 85 hours a week.
Yeah.
You know, there's some wear and tear going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not that I don't love what I do. I do. I absolutely adore it.
Yeah.
But this week is a good example. I'm closed this week between Christmas and New Year's so that I can be working on the new book. It is now 5:40.
Yep.
And I haven't written a word yet today except for the blog.
Oh, gosh.
And that's without teaching. I still had to do other things to keep the studio alive. That's just what you have to do.
Yeah, it's really... The business of being a writer, the business of entrepreneurship is not easy.
No, it's not for the weak. That's for sure.
So I'm curious, you know, we talked about you're very disciplined in mornings are the workshop, afternoons are for writing, evenings are preparing for the next day workshop.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned you set aside time to read manuscripts. What sort of coaching... What does the life of the workshop look like for you?
The life of the workshop, you know, I call people either students or clients.
Mm-hmm.
The students are the people who are in the classes and the workshops.
Mm-hmm.
The clients are the people who work with me or someone on my faculty one-on-one.
Yeah.
So people who are in the workshops are... That's a very typical workshop. You know, you come in, you read your work out loud, you get a feedback from everybody around you. The teacher also takes the work home, does a line-by-line edit, a written critique, and hands it back.
Mm.
We also have some workshops that are specifically for people who are writing books. And in that case, the manuscripts are handed around to everybody before we meet, and everybody comes to the table having already read the work. So everybody goes every week in terms of getting their stuff critiqued, and they can keep moving forward every week. The how-to classes are exactly that. We have topics like beginning fiction, introduction to poetry, how to write the personal essay. Then we go into more specific genre writing, you know, solving the mystery. My husband teaches that. We have a grammar class. We have a flash fiction class. So those are all specifically how-to. Each week you get a lecture, you have an assignment, it gets corrected. Coaching is the most intense thing you can do.
Mm-hmm.
You are able, in terms of prose, you are able to hand in up to 20 double-spaced pages a week.
Okay.
And I say up to because I don't want people to feel like, oh, I'm only producing 5 pages a week. It's not worth it. Mm-hmm. It is worth it.
Yeah.
Most people don't do 20 pages a week unless they're on the rewrite. Then mm-hmm. the 20 pages comes a little easier. They meet with their coach for an hour every week. The coach does a full line-by-line edit, writes a critique, but also keeps an eye on the overall project. If someone is writing a short story, they will then help them write the cover letter for that story. They'll make sure it's set up in proper publishing format, and they will show the writer how to look for the markets.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll come up with a list of 5 markets for every story for them to send it out to.
Wow.
In the case of a book, when the book is done, the coach will help them write a query letter, 3 different lengths of a synopsis, a 5-page, a 3-page, and a 1-page, because mm-hmm. those are the most commonly asked for lengths. And then we'll again show them where do we find the markets. The coach will come up with a list of 20 publishers or agents if the writer chooses to go that route. So will the student. And so then we compare lists, and where we agree, that's who gets targeted.
Okay.
So it's very, very intense. We have a very high success rate. The majority mm-hmm. of our coaching clients go on to have the books published.
Yeah.
I've lost count how many books have come out of the studio. It got to be too hard to keep up with mm-hmm. because they were coming out left and right. I do believe in traditional publishing. I do not like self-publishing. I have never believed that a writer should pay to have their work published. They mm-hmm. should be paid for their work.
Yeah.
So I push traditional publishing, but we do have some people who decide to go the self-publishing route.
And now are there agents and editors and publishers who know to sniff around the workshop?
Yes.
They come looking?
I know so many publishers. It's amazing. I feel we always talk about publishers having a stable of writers.
Mm-hmm.
I have a stable of publishers.
Yeah.
And I'm a matchmaker. You know, I match the book up with the publisher. And I am told anyway by these publishers that if they see something come across the desk that says the writer has worked with me or with the studio, mm-hmm. it comes off the slush pile right away.
That's wonderful.
So we have a good reputation.
Very cool. And how has teaching impacted your writing and your writing practice?
I don't know that it's impacted my practice any, but I feel like I have to be writing in order to teach.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on my way up, I did run into some teachers who hadn't published in like 10 years.
Yeah.
And didn't want to write what I wanted to write. You know, I would walk into a class that was supposed to be for fiction and it was being taught by somebody who had a background in poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And that was definitely not what I wanted to offer here.
Yeah.
And so everyone who teaches for me has to be publishing within the last 2 years so that we have cutting edge information. So I would say if anything, teaching has made me even more committed to writing because I feel like I have to be a role model to my students.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm not writing, then what the heck am I doing teaching?
Right.
So it makes me even fiercer, I guess, in terms of getting the work done.
Yeah. Well, and it shows 15 books in 14 years.
It certainly does. Though, to be fair, I mean, there was a method to my madness.
Mm-hmm.
The first book, when it came out, I had been writing a short story collection. A book takes a year in production usually. Yeah. So I already had that book well underway. So then the next book came out. Then eventually, like, I put out Oddities and Endings is a short story collection of all my stories that have been in magazines mm-hmm. and anthologies. So obviously I didn't have to write that book.
Right.
So while it was in production, I was writing already well ahead of the production line.
Yeah.
So while it looks like I came out with a book a year, pretty much, mm-hmm. there were years when it was literally taking things that were already written, putting them into a poetry collection, putting them into a short story collection. The book with the blog, mm-hmm. already written.
Sure.
You know? Right. So yeah, I mean, people will say, how do you put out a book a year? And I'm like, I really don't. It takes me about 2 years to write a book.
So you also mentioned, you know, earlier in your career, you were known for short stories.
Yes.
When you were writing short stories, was, I don't want to say getting to a novel the goal, but was, how did you branch into, you've mentioned you've got poetry collections, you've got short story collections, you've got the book of essays based on the blog, you've got novels. Do you move pretty easily between those formats, or do you have years that are heavy novel years and then you take a break and go into short stories, or how have they worked for you?
I mean, I've always written in all genres, fiction, mm-hmm. poetry, nonfiction, and it does seem to come to me pretty naturally. You know, I mean, there are times that I have an idea and I sit down and I start to write what I think is a short story, but it turns into a poem.
Mm-hmm.
There was one amazing time I was at a hotel. And at that point, I had a little teeny tiny house with three teenagers and a baby and my husband
mm-hmm.
and one bathroom. And so when I was in a hotel, I soaked in the tub,
sure.
you know,
yeah.
And while I was in the tub, I was thinking, oh, you know, I think I want to write this novel. And I was in my head writing out the steps that the novel would take. And when I got out of the tub, I wrote them all down and realized it was already written. It was a flash fiction story.
Mm.
And, you know, you just don't know until you start working on it.
Yeah.
When the word brand came out and we began to hear it a lot, writers need to brand themselves.
Right.
I don't believe in that at all.
Okay.
You know, it's if I branded myself, I would be stuck in one genre.
Mm-hmm.
And writing is a creative life and it's a creative profession. And you should write what you feel like writing and you'll find a home for it.
Mm-hmm.
So people will tell me, I will have magazine editors contact me and say, can you submit something to us? We'd love to have a Kathy Giorgio short story. And I'll say, okay, tell me what you think that is so I know what to send you. And they're like, we don't know. And I'm like, well, I don't know either. So
yeah.
I'll just send you something. And I think that's a gift.
Yeah.
You know, that you're just able to write what hits your head
mm-hmm.
and bring it out. So I don't have any trouble going between them. I typically don't know what I'm writing until I'm partway into it and mm-hmm. then realize what it's becoming. But I think, again, that goes back to the whole, do you plan or do you write by the seat of your pants
yeah.
thing? I let myself just write
yeah.
and amazing things happen.
When do you know that a piece is done?
That's the ultimate question, isn't it?
When the publisher won't let you make any more edits.
Yes, pretty much. And you're like, well, for example, right now with the book I'm working on, I keep track when I start a draft, when I finish a draft, and how many words the book is.
Okay.
And usually between draft 1 and 2 and 2 and 3, I will see huge leaps in word count mm-hmm. because I'm adding and adding and adding. And then I'll see it start to shrink.
Okay.
And when I get to the point that I finish a draft and I maybe changed 4 words,
okay,
it's done. But it's also a feeling. Mm-hmm. And it's a feeling that makes writers uncomfortable. And I tell them, if you get to the end of a story or a poem or a book, and just for a moment you stop and you fold your hands and you think, damn, I'm good.
Mm-hmm.
listen to it.
Yeah.
Because most of the time we're saying, oh my God, what am I doing this for? You know, nobody wants to read. Even after 15 books, you know, you can still say, oh God, somebody hated that book. And why am I doing this? It's all been such a fluke.
Mm-hmm.
If you have that damn I'm good moment and it's not the first draft, you know, listen to it. Because that's a really good, solid way of knowing you've really done your best.
Yeah.
And even you think it's good.
Yeah. Amazing. What haven't I asked you about writing that you'd be bummed if we hung up and you didn't get to talk about?
You've asked a lot.
That's my job.
I guess we could talk a little bit about some of the downfalls.
Okay.
And because I know, like I said, I come across as very enthused about writing, and I am. But as I just said, you can have 15 books out and still question your worth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think writers are the weirdest conundrum of absolute ego. I write great and I can write something and everybody is going to want to read it. Followed immediately by absolutely crippling lack of self-confidence.
Yeah.
And we can switch on a dime.
Yeah.
We tend to remember the rejections more than we remember the acceptances. Mm-hmm. I just went through a thing that I'm currently writing about where I told you I have this creative writing teacher who's still one of my friends.
Mm-hmm.
And at this particular school that I graduated from, I loved being at this high school.
Yeah.
And it had classes like growing up in literature and reality, science fiction and fantasy, mystery and the macabre, creative writing, journalism. We had a creative writing magazine. And we, the artists and the writers in this school and the musicians, were lauded as much as the sports folks.
Mm.
It was incredible.
What a special place.
I was only there for 3 semesters and I loved it. I wrote a story that ended up in the Creative Writing Magazine, which weirdly is set in heaven, like my latest book.
Mm-hmm.
It was called In God We Trust. This would have been 1978. And it was, like I said, set in heaven. God was actually a computer.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, computers took up entire buildings.
Yep.
You know, I mean, they were huge. Jesus was what I called the computer mechanic because the word technician hadn't come out yet.
Mm-hmm.
The angel Gabriel was an anxiety riddled manager type.
Mm-hmm.
And what was his name? The guy who blew the trumpet, Joshua or something like that.
Yeah.
He was a drug addicted jazz playing trumpet player.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole story ended up on the day that was supposedly the day of reckoning. God broke down. The computer broke down.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the symptoms that we read about the day of reckoning in the Bible did happen. The people of Earth looked up and said, oh, how about that? And then just kept on going because all it was a computer breaking down.
Mm.
The Creative Writing Magazine said they wanted to publish it.
Yeah.
Word got leaked to the parents, who said the story should not be allowed in, that it was sacrilegious, and it had no place in a magazine being published by a public school.
Mm.
My creative writing teacher defended me to the administration, and the administration defended me to the parents, and the story was published anyway. So it was my first real experience with censorship and with possible banning.
Yeah.
So now we fast forward. I graduated in 78. This is 2023.
Mm-hmm.
I have appeared at that high school many times to speak with the students. I started a program called Authors in the Schools through the Southeast Wisconsin Festival of Books, where we would bring in authors into the schools. And my books were in the school library. There was a sweep of the schools, the whole school district, last fall, and my books were removed. They were banned.
Mm.
But I am on that school's wall of stars as a successful alumni. So people in those schools can now read my name on the wall of stars, but they can't check my books out. And you know, the reason I'm writing about this, I'm hoping that article is going to come out. I'm not going to say with who yet, but it's out there because someone asked me to write it. What happens to a writer when their books are banned?
Yeah.
You know, and if you're a huge writer, if you're with the big publishers, there's usually a media outcry. people run to the stores, they buy the book, she ends up on the New York Times bestseller list.
Right.
For those of us with the small presses, not much happens.
Yeah.
You know, the books disappear. And you do end up going through a time. I mean, I sat down and thought, are my books hurting people?
Mm-hmm.
Did I do something that could affect somebody in such a negative way that they shouldn't have read the book? I mean, I spent several months stumbling. Mm-hmm. I had trouble writing the new book, wondering, was my writing worthwhile? Was I worthwhile? And that's happening to me now,
mm-hmm.
15 books in.
Yeah.
Awards in.
Yeah.
You know, all of this. So writers have to learn to deal with that. We have to learn to deal with those moments of, who am I and why am I doing this and should I even be doing it? Because honestly, there's rewards, but there are things that the general public looks at as successful, like living off your writing,
mm-hmm.
being able to support yourself with your writing, which doesn't happen.
Right.
You know, even the big names that we see, of course, everyone thinks of Stephen King right away.
Right.
Stephen King made his money on his movies, not his mm-hmm. books. J.K. Rowling makes her money on the
licensing. Yeah.
Yes, the licensing and the movies.
Yeah.
James Patterson incorporated himself and has other writers writing his books for him so he can put out many books a year. We don't have that. We have to find our successes and our sense of worth in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes those ways are hard to find. So it's, again, that's part of the reason for the studio. We have people here that know your worth, that know that what you're doing is worthwhile and important, even if you don't roll in the money because of it. And ultimately, even if it gets banned, you know, that's sometimes people who just really have an incredible sense of ignorance and don't know what they're doing when they're pulling these books off the shelves.
Yeah.
So we'd have to talk about that.
Yeah. At my synagogue, we hosted the inaugural Chicago Jewish Book Festival this summer.
Cool.
And for Shabbat, we had a librarian from Milwaukee come down and we did a banned book Shabbat. And her sermon was about explaining the impact of this modern banning, this last few years of what's been happening, and how it's being driven by so few people. It's something like 92% of the book banning requests are being filed by like 10 people.
Right.
And it's, the statistics are mind-boggling. The whiplash of seeing this all happen, the dominoes start to fall so quickly has been, I mean, that's the point of it, is that it's to shock you into helplessness.
Right.
But I think what I hadn't thought about is the small independent writers who get swept up in that. And it's not news, but it is huge.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge impact on your life.
You bet. And often in those cases, the banning is actually successful. It does what they want it to do. It mm-hmm. takes the books away from the readers.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I've had people say to me, oh, congratulations, your books have been banned. And I'm like, there is no congratulations. No. So honestly, go out and buy my books.
Yes. Request them from your libraries. Buy the books.
Yes.
We'll link, Kathy, we'll link to your website. We'll link through bookshop.org to your author's page and to your books there. Folks should be ready to pre-order your next book when it is available.
Yep.
It's been a blast getting to know you tonight. I really appreciate the time.
Thanks. It was fun.
Yeah. Where would you like people to find you on the internet?
They can find me anywhere on the internet, but they can find me at my website, with this kathygiorgio.org. You can also find me on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram.
Outstanding. You can follow Finding Favorites on Instagram at Finding Faves Pod. Send me an email at findingfavoritespodcast@gmail.com to pitch yourself as a guest or send me ideas for future guests. And head over to Apple Podcasts, rate it 5 stars. If it matters for the big podcast, it matters for the independent podcast too.
You bet.
So again, Kathy, thank you so much. This has been wonderful.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.